This Aliyah of Parshas Kisavo has many fascinating concepts alluded to and indicated. We won't be able to talk about all of them in depth because there's a lot, so we'll try to call attention to what we can in the time that we have, and whatever we can't fill in today, hopefully 7 years from now we'll come back to and talk a little bit more. We're talking about Shemitah recently, so a 7-year cycle doesn't seem so crazy. So we'll try to say what we can about this jam-packed fifth aliyah, where the Torah begins by telling us, Vayitzav Moshe es ha'am b'yom ahu le'mor. So on that day, the commandment was the recitation of the brachos and the klolos. Elo yamdu levarech es ha'am al hargrizim b'ovrechem es ha'yardein, Shimon v'levi v'yehuda v'yisachar v'yosef v'binyamin, v'elo yamdu al ha'klola b'har eval, Ruvein gad v'yasher zvulun dan v'naftali v'anu ha'levim v'amru el kalish Yisrael choram. So here you have the positioning of the different shvatim on the mountains and the recitation of these curses and of these brachos and the Levim bringing about the statement of Amen from everybody. So as Rav Hirsch explains about this whole section, and as others point out, that the mitzvah here is that the people will accept upon themselves the content of these curses and these brachos. So the idea of the Levim standing there in the middle is that the Levim are not speaking to the people, but rather they are speaking for them in order to bring about this Amen, and therefore the acceptance on the part of the people. The Gemara tells us in Masechet Sota, on Daf Lamed Zayin Amud Aleph, that the bris of every mitzvah has a number of components to it. That we take a bris, lomod, lalamed, lishmor, velasos, to take a 4-point bris that we will learn and that we will teach, we will be shomer, we will do. And it seems like that is, in essence, what's going on here, that many of these klolos, these brachos, are references to not only specific details of the Torah, but also to the idea of accepting the entire totality of the bris, of the covenant. And the idea that every mitzvah has all these different components to it is one that was discussed at length by the Heilige Avnei Nezer. Tzach HaShavir Rebbe discusses this in a few places, where he talks about the role of Talmud Torah as not just an independent mitzvah, but a component of each and every mitzvah. That part of the mitzvah is not only its performance, but also its study. And in his very often quoted introduction to a Sefer on Hilchos Shabbos, Eglei Tal, so he talks about this at length as well in his tshuvas. So one point that he makes elsewhere in another one of his tshuvas is one that I think will allow us a moment of super synergy. So we'll very happily discuss. You may recall that a few days ago we spoke about Prozbul, and we raised the question of how Prozbul works and why it exists. And we suggested at the time that maybe essentially Chazal had made a mechanism by which Shemitah is not going to cancel loans. But nonetheless, they didn't make that automatic. They wanted us to still opt into that process and to do the Prozbul and to involve ourselves in that, so that the concept is still honored, so that the concept of Shemitah's Kesafim is still represented and is still recollected, and that therefore the Prozbul is a way, we mentioned like Chalitza is a way of saying that Yibum is the ideal, even if that's not what's happening, and so too Prozbul will serve the same role for Shemitah's Kesafim. So here's a moment of super synergy for you. The Avnei Nezer and Achuva says about this concept, about these brisos. Says, so what about Shemitah? So when it comes to Shemitah, so the idea of observing Shemitah midrabanan, so why do we do that? So Rashi says in Maseches Gittin, Shelo tishtakach Torah Shvias, that we shouldn't forget about the concept of Shvias. So Chazal instituted Shvias drabanan, and that there should be Shemitah's Kesafim drabanan. All of that is a function of the idea that we don't want to forget about Shvias. The Avnei Nezer in his Tshuva, he says, well, what exactly are we worried about? That if there's no mitzvah d'oraisa of Shvias right now, so are we making a gzeirah l'gzeirah? We're saying that we should institute Shvias drabanan, and that itself is so that we shouldn't forget about it, but the mitzvah isn't applicable right now. What exactly is the nature of that kind of an enactment? So he suggests that this is a function of this bris. The bris has 4 parts to it. So the idea that we should also protect the concept, that we shouldn't forget about a mitzvah, that's a part of the bris that we took at this time, and therefore Shvius, even if we're in a generation where Shvius is not being practiced, so we still take action, Shlo Tishtakach Torah Shvius, and therefore we have the whole institution of Shemitah Derabbanan. So that's a very important postscript to what we spoke about just a few days ago, talking about a prose bowl, and it fits well with the idea that we suggested that the reason Chazal didn't just simply make it an automatic Tanai and allow everyone just to have their loans continue, but rather commanded us, or worked it out, that we have to do so through a method like prose bowl, essentially keeps the Torah Shvius alive, and has this alternative route to it, that we are going to remember the idea of Shemitah's Kesafim through the invoking of prose bowl. And we could also add that as far as the whole mechanism of prose bowl in the first place, and we discussed to what extent is it overriding the Torah, is it not overriding the Torah, and we emphasized, first of all, that Shemitah B'zman Hazeh is not a mitzvah from the Torah, so that was a crucial component, but also about the internal logic that dictated that Hillel should do this, how it restores the whole value back to its initial value of making sure that we're able to continue lending money. So here, if you understand it this way, so it's even more understandable how prose bowl fits in. That essentially Chazal were concerned, Shlo Tishtakach Torah Shvius, that there's no applicability of Shemitah nowadays. So Chazal wanted to make sure that the mentality of Shvius would still be preserved. So ideally, that was done by simply continuing Shvius, by having Shvius be observed on a level midrabanan, so that'd be the most absolute way of making sure that Shvius didn't disappear. But if that's not viable, if the fact is that people aren't getting loans that they need because of that, so then prose bowl became an alternate method. So we find within that perspective that prose bowl is not an overriding of the halacha, but it is fitting all of the original goals of the halacha. Now, on the one hand, it is upholding the key principle that loans should take place, but even the additional principle that was there, Shlo Tishtakach Torah Shvius, so prose bowl also will create the reality, Shlo Tishtakach Torah Shvius, that we don't forget about it because we have to do the prose bowl, which is in the place of the Hashmatas Kesafim. But it will also accomplish, perhaps arguably, the same goal as Shvius Drabana. Hi.
And similarly, if the problem is that people aren't lending money, that means they won't remember Shvius because there's
won't come up in the first place. Right, you know, that'll be an even worse problem, agave problem. But certainly, we're already worried enough about the idea of people not lending money in the first place. So if we had none of those things, people don't lend money and they don't remember Shvius, we'll have all the problems on top of each other. So this way, Hillel saw b'chachmaso that we can have the continuation of lending money, and we'll also preserve the memory of the concepts of Shvius, and that's the value. So how's that for some super synergy, this point really flowing directly and enhancing what we just spoke about a few days ago. So the truth is, what this phrase Shmira means is not so clear. We say, Lilmod Olamed Lishmor Velasos, so we can understand, okay, that to learn and to teach, that's the first two, and to do, that's the fourth, but what exactly is Shmira as a value? So it sounds like from the Gemara in Kiddushin that it's a reference to Mishnah, which also seems like learning. Lishmor Velasos is Mishnah and Maisa. So then the question is, okay, so what does that add on to the original learning? So the Marsha over there suggests, and this is an important value for all of us here in Yeshiva, that we're referring to Chazara, referring to not simply learning, but learning as an active tool to make sure that you hold on to what you've learned. So the first time is you learn it, and then teaching it is also a component, but also working to make sure that you hold on to it. That's an independent mitzvah. It's an independent component of every concept, and perhaps that's what's suggested through the notion of Shmira. Rav Aaron Cutler once gave a shmooze, where he suggested that we have a concept, everyone knows we have a concept of Bittul Torah, and what we normally talk about, Bittul Torah, is what you might call quantitative Bittul Torah, that we don't spend enough time learning, so we understand that that's Bittul Torah. But he wrote that there's also such a thing as qualitative Bittul Torah. He says that a person could be learning 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, let's say 364 days a year, and still he'd be Mevatel Torah. Why? Because he's going at such a pace and he's not stopping to review anything, so whatever he learns goes in one ear and out the other. So if he's not holding on to any of it, so that's also a type of Bittul Torah. So not engaging in Bittul Torah requires also this Shmira, requires also engaging in methods to make sure that you hold on to it, and therefore that's perhaps what the reference is. The Stipler was also quoted as saying that the first four times you learn something, it doesn't even count. That it's only after the fifth time when you're starting to do it again and again, that's you start learning. So you could suggest that that's also an interpretation here in terms of different levels. The Sefer Yireim understands the idea of Shmira to say we should make sure not to forget the mitzvot themselves, Shomar to protect. And in the Sefer Chavetzelis HaSharon, he has a little essay about this in Parshas Kisavo, where he suggests also that it means a Hechsher mitzvah. It means that the things that we have to do to make sure that the mitzvah is not lost opportunity-wise. So, for example, we'll have a good example coming up in a few weeks. So it's not so clear that there is a mitzvah to build a sukkah. We know there's a mitzvah to live in a sukkah over sukkahs. Is there a mitzvah to build a sukkah? Not so clear. It seems like it's really in the category of a heksha mitzvah. It seems like it's in the category of something we do to prepare for a mitzvah. So one could theoretically say, okay, so now comes sukkah's time, and comes sukkah's night. I just don't have a sukkah. I never built one. Wasn't commanded to do so, so now I don't have a sukkah. What do you expect me to do? I'm an honest. So a part of the mitzvah experience is to also protect the opportunity, to make sure that we can do that. So therefore, that's included, in a sense, in the mitzvah, to make sure that we're not going to find ourselves in a situation where the mitzvah is lost. Perhaps to give a previous example, an earlier example than Sukkot. So before Sukkot, we have Yom Kippur. So there is a mitzvah to eat on Erev Yom Kippur, according to the Gemara. And some write, so for example, the Ritva, in his commentary to Maseches Rosh Hashanah, the Ritva writes, "Solo yovo lidei bitulinoi," that we're worried that if somebody's going to decide, okay, Erev Yom Kippur is a good day for him to go base jumping, what was it we were talking about yesterday, to do one of those extreme activities and also fast, so he's not going to eat anything and he's going to exert himself tremendously, and then come Yom Kippur night, so he's about to collapse if he doesn't have a drink, if he doesn't have something to eat, so they say, okay, what do you want from me? It's pikuach nefesh, I have to eat. So that might be true, but it was your responsibility to prepare in advance and to make sure that you're not in that position. So there is this role of shmira, of the mitzvah, to make sure that the mitzvah is protected, and that's evoked in this phrase you find in the Ritva, shol yavo lidei bitulinoi, that there is a mitzvah to eat the day before so that the mitzvah the next day is preserved, that we don't find ourselves in a situation where we find that mitzvah getting lost. This, again, we said the Chazara point is very important for yeshiva students, and that's true, but there are a couple of Musar Haskels in this whole idea, but also the recognition that Talmud Torah is a mitzvah in and of itself, but also it's a part of the bris of every individual mitzvah. So the idea that the mitzvah has all these different components to it, the practicing of the mitzvah, the learning about the mitzvah, the internalizing of the value of the mitzvah, all of that is a part of the bris of each individual mitzvah, and that's a part of what we try to do here when we engage in advanced Torah study, is to perform the mitzvah of Talmud Torah in the general sense, but also the recognition that a part of our acceptance of the mitzvos is understanding their implications and their details and everything that comes along with it. And in that way, the Talmud Torah is another track of fulfillment in addition to its independent mitzvah. Okay, so we now find a whole list of curses. They're not edited out. So we have all the arurs, the next many psukim for the majority of the Soliyah. And we won't go through all of them in detail. The first one talks about Avodah Zarah, and talks about Avodah Zarah in the sense of somebody who will make a Pesel, a Masecha, and it's interesting that this is phrased in the future. Some suggest that even though all the other Arurs are talking about things that one has done or one is doing, but here it's phrased in the future, Asher Yaseh. So some suggest this has to do with the fact that Avodah Zarah, Gemara tells us that Avodah Zarah is different than all other Averos because it takes place on an intellectual level as well, and that whatever actions one does towards Avodah Zarah end up getting combined with the intent. And therefore, one could theoretically be sinning in the area of Avodah Zarah before he's actually done anything. When it comes to other Averos, if you haven't actually done anything, so you don't really have an Avera here, but one who is planning on making a idol and is therefore already in the mindset of idolatry, so there's already what to talk about. Some suggest that that's what the language of the future tense that you find in this pasuk is meant to convey. But in any event, Rav Hirsch and others suggest that the theme that you find in all of these orders here is that most of them, or not all of them, are ways in which a person could be outwardly respectable and yet do all kinds of things in private that are wrong, or have all kinds of secret intentions or all kinds of inner lives that are reprehensible. And therefore, the Torah is telling us that even if this is not something that's overtly punishable in the outside world, this is still something that seriously degrades your character and takes you away from your avoda. And therefore, we're referring to those as well. So here we have a pasuk, Arur Makle Aviv Imo, Avyamar Kol Amameng. So there is a prohibition to be mezalzel, to create a lightness of the parents. The literal translation, this is really the opposite, literally, of the phrase kibud avim. That kibud, we say, to give honor. So kavod comes from the language of kaved. It means to give weight to. So when you honor somebody, you give them chashivas, you give them weight, you give them stature. So linguistically and thematically, this is in essence the opposite. This is saying that somebody is making their parents light, from the word kal. And that's certainly the opposite direction. But it's an important question, what exactly then are we addressing here? So is this just a lack of kavod, or is this the aggressive opposite of kavod? It's a different thing. That when it comes to kavod, so we have different terminologies when we talk about how we treat our parents. So we have an obligation of kavod, it's affirmative honor to our parents. And then we have an obligation of mora. Mora means that we refrain from doing things which would be too casual. We don't sit in our parents' chair. We don't refer to them by their first names. Things like that. And it seems that there is a lower level too, what we call bizayon, that if one humiliates his parents, so that is more than failing to be mechabed them or even failing to show reverence, but it's going very far in the opposite direction, and that's a serious transgression, which perhaps this pasuk is really referring to. And the Netziv has a tshuva where he writes in the Meshuv Dover that even though we know that we have a rule, melech shemachal al kvodo in kvodo machal, but a parent is machal on kvodo, kvodo machal. That if a parent says, listen, I know that you have to do such and such through the dinim of the Torah to be mechabed me, but I'm machal, you don't have to do it. So that mechila takes effect, that you're not obligated to do that which a parent says they're machal and they're not asking you to do. We normally understand that to be a function of zehu kvodo, that the parent has the right to define what is considered kavod, and if they say that even though normally to act in such and such a fashion is considered kavod, but I don't want it, I'm happier without it, so then that is his definition of kavod or her definition of kavod, and that becomes the mitzvah. The Netziv writes, though, that that's only true for kavod, that's not true for bizayon, that bizayon remains a prohibition, and that even if the parent ostensibly says the mochel, doesn't matter, one is still prohibited to be makla, to be mevaza, the parents, and it's not going to change even if the parents say it's okay. So that's an important consideration. Next pasuk, hi.
What's the svar meaning if they're fine with, if they don't feel it's a bizayon, then how's it a bizayon?
Because there's a certain objective bizayon, that if a person, if the rabbim look at the parents and they see that because of what you're doing, they see the parents in a disgraced fashion, so then the fact that they don't care, that's not going to change anything. That's still, and it probably touches upon the point that when it comes to kibud av v'em, as the Mechas Chinuch emphasized, there really are two different tracks. There's a ben adam l'chavero track and a ben adam l'makom track. On the one hand, there is a hakar satov to the parents for everything that they've done. That's the Ben Adam L'Chavero track. And there is the Ben Adam L'Makom track, that the parents are partners with God in the creation of people, and we can't directly be mechabed God because we don't interact in the same way. So we show honor to our parents as a stand-in for the honor we'd like to show to God. So to a certain extent, they have control. They can be mochel. And to a certain extent, they can't. That if it's going to be a bizayon to where we come from, so then that's a bizayon to God as well. And it's not up to them to say it's okay. It's also not clear that anybody really has the right to allow their own bizayon. That's a discussion as well. And therefore, all the more so that there may be an inherent inability to be mochel for that reason. And therefore, it might not be a prat necessarily in kibud av v'em. It might just be that bizayon, by its very nature, is not something that is given to mechila, and therefore bizayon av v'em is going to be more objective as opposed to Kibarabe. Okay, a lot of orders here. We won't have time to go into detail of all of them. The next one, though, is worthy of discussion, hopefully maybe at a different time. Aror Masig Gvul Riehu V'Omar Kol Amamei Masig Gvul. Here, so this is literally a reference, as Rashi explains, you're stealing land. But you're stealing land in a sneaky way by moving the border when nobody's looking, so then you'll be able to maintain that it was yours all along. So again, you have this outward respectability, but meanwhile you're doing bad things. In modern day halachic usage, so we find this also applied to ruinous competition, to unfair competition, which is also taken on the term hasagas gvul, and you find in the halachic literature, it's also invoked in the context of plagiarism, that if you're taking somebody else's Torah and making it yours, that's also more of an intellectual moving of the borders, moving of the point where it comes from, and you find this kind of terminology in all those contexts. And then the next pasuk, Arur Mashge Iver Badarech, so cursed is one who makes the Iver messed up on the path. So this is considered to be a reformulation of the idea of Lufnei Iver Lo Sitein Michshol, that we can't trip a blind person. And that prohibition has many different applications. The literal application that you should not cause a physically sightless person to fall. But Chazal told us that it has other applications as well. It has the application of spiritually tripping up somebody who is spiritually blind, meaning that they are prone to a certain type of transgression. So helping them along that path, to helping them to trip on that path by enabling the sin, that's the Fnei Iver. And we know also that giving bad advice is considered to be a prohibition of the Fnei Iver, because a different kind of blindness, a person doesn't have all the information they need in order to function effectively, and you will help them fall by giving them bad advice, that's a prohibition of the Fnei Iver. And here Rashi quotes that, as Rashi recording the Torah's Kodim to Kedoshim, the Pasuk of Fnei Iver, and applies it here. He says, Mashke Iver, that's a Suma Badaver, Umasiyo Eitzara, a person is blind in one area, in one aspect of life, and you are giving them bad advice, and that's going to create problems. So the next psukim continue. We're matem mishpat ger yasom v'almana, that if you're going to tilt, if you're going to lean away the justice of a ger, of a yaslam, an almana, all of that is also subject to a klala, and then a number of principles of arayas, arosh achev meishas aviv, arosh achev mikol behema, arosh achev machoso, basavu basimo, arosh achev mikol santo. All of those next few psukim getting up to Pasuk of Dalet. So Pasuk of Dalet says, Arur Maker Yehu Basaser. So what does that mean? Somebody who hits his neighbor in secret? So hitting his neighbor in secret, so that Rashi tells us that's a reference to Lashon Hara. Lashon Hara, the person doesn't see, you're talking behind their back, and therefore that's called Maker Yehu Basaser. So that's an interesting question to explore. Because one could get the impression from this Rashi is quoting again from Chazal, so one could get the impression that that's what Lashon Hara is. The Lashon Hara is Maka Reyehu Basaser, and that you are essentially doing something behind someone's back. You're speaking about somebody when they can't hear you. So you could perhaps get the impression that, okay, so if I'm doing it openly, if I'm not doing it behind the person's back, so then, that's not Lashon Hara. So, that's a hard conclusion to come to. We would think, halacha l'maisa, that if you are embarrassing somebody by talking in front of them, so then you're compounding the Lashon Hara. So it's not just Lashon Hara, it's also halbanus p'nei chaver barabim, it's worse. So that's what the Chafetz Chaim writes. Chafetz Chaim writes that if you speak about somebody behind their back, so that's what this pasuk says, makareihu basaser. But if you speak about them in front of them, so it's worse, because then you're also being malbim p'nei chaveru b'rabim. Question about that?
Kind of. It reminds me in Gemara and Rachim.
Oh, someone's talking.
It's not just Lashon Hara, it's also Chutzpah.
Oh, right. So that Gemara was responding to something we'll talk about now. So the truth is, this conclusion that one could have from this Rashi here, that without the Chafetz Chaim, that Lashon Hara is specifically when you're speaking not in front of someone. So that, the Gemara that Arya is quoting the next line from, the Gemara in Erechin, has a suggestion along those lines. The Gemara has a suggestion that something that's said in the presence of the subject, called Milsa de Is Amris Ape Mara, Less buhu mishum lashon bisha. If you say something in the subject's presence, that's not lashon hara. So that's very hard to believe, practically speaking, because again, you're adding the to the avera. It doesn't seem like it's any better. And there are those who seem to believe that this is a das yachid in Chazal, and it's not accepted halacha l'maisa. Some say that explicitly. The Rambam seems to be of this position, because the Rambam doesn't give any indication. The Rambam, who was one of the first to really codify hilchos lashon hara in Hilchos Deis, so he doesn't give any indication of any exception when the person is there, possibly because he felt this was a das yachid in the Gemara. But there are those who did see this as having some relevance, as perhaps reflecting something about Hilchos Lashon Hara. Again, it would still mean that you're still doing something very wrong if you're speaking somebody's presence and embarrassing them, but maybe as far as Lashon Hara is concerned, maybe it's not that. Maybe it's something else. So, for example, the Sefer Yireiim writes that the idea is there's a pasuk in Yirmiyahu, if I remember correctly, that the phrase Rechilus that we find the Torah uses to identify Lashon Hara, so the pasuk says, Holchei Rachel Nechoshes with Barzel, something along those lines, that these people who walk around telling stories, they're like copper and iron. So what does that mean? So the Yireiim understands, it means they're two-faced. It means that when they're with you, they're like copper, they're all nice and shiny, and when they're not there, they got the sword out. So essentially, the people show you two faces, they're friendly when they're with you, but when you're not around, they're talking behind your back. That's the midah of a rochel, that pasuk suggests. So the Sefer Yireiim understands in that sense that that's what the Gemara means, that yeah, the Lashon Hara is specifically somebody who will stab you in the back, from behind your back, but not somebody who's going to hit you from the front. And that's not Lashon Hara, it'll be other things maybe. So along these lines, you have a statement of the Maharal of Prague, who wrote extensively about Lashon Hara in his Sfarim. So the Maharal also seems to understand that Lashon Hara is not when the person is there. And he has a little bit of a difficult language to explain what he's getting at. So to try to roughly translate what he's saying, it's not so easy. It seems like he's saying that the whole nature of Lashon Hara is that basically it is a weapon that you use from a distance. That you want to hurt someone and you're not in their presence, so you can do that by talking about them somewhere else. And then you'll cause them problems that you can't do when you can do even without being physically in front of them. But if you were physically in front of them and you want to fight with them, then you hit them, then you kick them, you do something else. So the very nature of Lashon Hara, as he understands it, is attacking from a distance and specifically not attacking when the person is there in front of you. And that's what it sounds like he's saying. Again, his language is a little bit mysterious. And then he goes on to say that, to make reference also to the idea that when the person's there, they can defend themselves. So it's a whole different kind of attack. So there's a big difference between talking to somebody when they are present and they can saying something bad about them when they can actually respond, and doing so when they don't have the ability to respond. It's all functionally a different type of offense. So the Chafetz Chaim quotes this Maharal, others quote this Maharal, and they say that there's a proof against it, besides the fact that it's just hard to believe practically that it's any better to speak Lashon Hara when the person is in front of you. But maybe there's a proof textually against it, that we know that Miriam, when she spoke badly about Moshe, so that seems to be one of the paradigmatic examples of Lashon Hara. We're supposed to remember what Miriam did to keep us away from Lashon Hara like she did. And yet, there is an opinion in the Medrash that Moshe was present at the time. I don't know if we often envision it. We try to envision what was going on in this conversation between Miriam and Aaron. We don't necessarily picture Moshe as being in the room, but there was an opinion in the Medrash that he was in the room. So the Chafetz Chaim and others ask against the Maharal, you see, that that's Lashon Hara, and this is not just an Aveira, it's not some other Aveira. It's clear that what Miriam did is associated specifically with Lashon Hara, and according to this view, it wasn't Moshe's presence. So it sounds like there is Lashon Hara even in the presence of the person you're talking about. So the Maharal, as you know, was very influential with his philosophical writings and his whole mahalach in life. So in the 20th century, some of his intellectual inheritors took it upon themselves to explain this Maharal. And you find in many different Svarim, perhaps most prominently the Pachad Yitzchok of Rav Huttner, who was one who followed very much in the path of the Maharal. So in a Sefer on Shavuos, the Maharal is that Pachad Yitzchak with Hutner in a Sefer and Shavuos explains this Maharal, and you can find a few other 20th century Sfarim where they also take a similar path in trying to explain what the Maharal is getting at in light of this Medrash. And they all say something along the following lines, different versions of the same idea. And they say that there's different kinds of Lashon Hara. That there's Lashon Hara where you're saying something essentially factual. You're saying something bad based on facts. So there, if that's said in the presence of the subject, that's taka, not Lashon Hara. That's what the Maharal is getting at. So when you say something bad about a person factually and the person is there, that's not Lashon Hara. Now it could be, because again, if there was anything that was inaccurate, so the person could respond. If there was a factual, unfair statement, so then the person, by being there, has the ability to address that, perhaps. Maybe that's the case. But there's also another kind of Lashon Hara, and this is crucially important for our contemporary understanding of Lashon Hara. There's also another type of Lashon Hara, and that is where you're not saying any specific fact or introducing any fact into the conversation that wasn't there before, but you are introducing an assessment. It's basically a lack of Betzedek Tishbot Amizecha, that you're not judging the other one favorably, which is intertwined with Lashon Hara as well, that you're giving a ungenerous assessment of somebody else, and that is a form of Lashon Hara that's not mitigated by the person being there. And he doesn't exactly say this, but you could say along the same lines that if I say something factually, if I say David is an axe murderer, so he's right here, so you could say, that's not true, I'm not an axe murderer, and you know, you'll have your say. But if I say that David the axe murderer has no class, when he is not very artistic in his axe murdering, so what are you going to say? It's my assessment. I'm going to put you in a negative light, and there's nothing you can really respond. So that's going to be Lashon Hara regardless of the person there. That's going to be Lashon Hara no matter what. So that's how they try to explain. Again, you can find this in the Pachad Yitzchak. In the Sefer of Rav Goldzich's Drashas, Tasufos Marachos, is a similar approach. I think it was written by his son-in-law, Rav Mirnik. And a few others who write very similar things about trying to explain this Maharal specifically in light of this question, and they say things along those lines, that if you're saying a factual allegation, then the person's there, it's not Lashon Hara. If you're making a negative assessment, an ungenerous judgment about somebody else, and the person's there, it doesn't help at all. So because that was what Miriam was doing, Miriam wasn't saying any fact that no one knew. Miriam was saying, oh, the fact that Moshe separated from his wife, that's something that reflects badly on him somehow. So the fact that he was there, that doesn't help at all. Hi.
Can someone write a negative review of, let's say, a book or a movie?
So that's an interesting question. It's you're asking specific, because this detail, or you're asking a general Lashon Hara question. So probably yes. I often say with these questions that the big questions are a distraction from the small questions. Because people ask, can you write a negative review? What about other things in the newspaper? Things like that. Is that Lashon Hara? So theoretically, there is a justification, and sometimes a very important justification, of Toelis in a lot of these areas. There's a justification of Toelis of a lot of things a newspaper is going to write. And in a different sense, there's usually often a justification of Toelis in a review also. Review is rarely the case that you're saving somebody from really being harmed. It's not in the Lo Samar Adam Re'echa case, where the newspaper might be dealing with something like that. But in a lower level, the person is going to spend his time and his money consuming a product, even just reading a book. So if it's going to be a waste of their time or money, so you're saving them from that minor loss. So theoretically, that's the Toelis, and that could be justified. However, it's still possible for somebody to engage in both the newspaper writing and the review writing and do so in ways that are grossly unfair, irresponsible, careless, overtly biased. So there's all kinds of ways that one can do very severe, egregious violations of Lashon Hara while doing these activities. So what I said before about the big questions and the small questions, so the big questions are, newspapers, reviews, the like, are they justifiable? Yeah, sometimes they're very, very necessary. But the devil is in the details, quite literally, that the way it's possible for terrible violations of Lashon Hara to happen while you're doing these things, and very often that next level isn't addressed. Oh, okay, it's toelos, everything's mutter, and I can write whatever I want. I don't have to be careful. I don't have to worry about being accurate. I don't have to worry about being fair. And one who's going to take that attitude is certainly going to be in violation of a lot of aspects of Lashon Hara. So, pretty much to that point, so we've said so far how many don't accept this Gemara about the person being present. Sefer Yireim understands it as one particular understanding in Lashon Hara. The Maharal understands it another way. So there's also a Tosfos. Tosfos understands this. Tosfos in Erechin and in Bava Basra combines this with another surprising idea, the idea of Ape Tlasa, that the Gemara says that is also no Lashon Hara if the matter is public. Which is very hard to understand. Many different views in Rishonim as to what it means, but we'll just focus on one that combines that statement with this statement. That Tosfos says that the idea that there's no Lashon Hara if you're saying something in public or if you're saying something in front of the person, so Tosfos suggests that what that means is we're not talking about you're actually saying something negative. We're talking about you're saying something which could be interpreted negatively or positively. And if that's the case, so really, probably shouldn't say it, because even if you mean it positively, but the listeners could interpret it negatively, so then you could end up doing harm. So we could say that you shouldn't say something that could be interpreted both ways because of the risk involved. So in that context, Tosfos suggests that that's what the Gemara is addressing, saying if normally such a thing should not be said. But if you're going to say it in public, or you're going to say it in the presence of the person you're speaking about, so then, it must be that you mean it to be interpreted positively. So, to give you an example, if I'm going to say, if I'm going to take you aside in private and say, this Horatio, you could always rely on him. You can always count on him. So, you don't know what I mean. Maybe I mean you can always count on him, he's reliable. Or maybe I mean you can always count on him to mess up. You can always count on him to make a mistake. So maybe I shouldn't say such a thing, because it could create a wrong impression, and that might be a problem with Lashon Hara. But if I'm saying it in public, getting up at the shul dinner and saying, Horatio, you can always count on him, and Horatio is sitting there in the front row, so then we could hope that I must mean it positively. Then we could hope the listeners should know that you mean it positively, and they'll interpret it in that sense. So that's something I think we really have to think about today in 2015, where a lot of our interactions are taking place over the internet and social media and Facebook and Twitter. So now it's not just Ape Tlasa, it's Ape 6 billion, 7 billion, right? The entire world wide web is seeing this, and generally that will include the person who you're talking about. So is it still true that we can assume that people would not be nasty with those contexts? I don't think so. I think that we've had a very big shift in our mentality and our consciousness, and that's something to seriously consider. And it's possible, unfortunately, for us to be makare of a saucer and still not even have it be so secret. So this pasuk has very strong implications and applications for our life today. It's something to really think about very seriously. Just to continue to get to a little bit more, because we're going to run out of time. So Arur Lokeach Shochad, Hakash Nefesh Dam Nakimar Kolamei. So that's an important idea also. But let's just go to the next pasuk. Arur Asher Lo Yakim Es Divrei HaTorah Hazos. So that's a very general statement. What does that mean? So cursed is he who's not going to uphold the Torah. So Rashi says this is a Kabbalah of all the mitzvahs of the Torah, that we're accepting the content of the Torah in its totality. And the Ramban has a statement like that as well, that this is an internal acceptance of the binding nature of the Torah, not just any specific mitzvah, but a recognition that it's applicable to all of us. And in that sense, it might be similar to Lo Sosser that we spoke about a little bit, which is about Dinim Drabanan, according to the Rambam. But one could say that Lo Sosser doesn't necessarily connect to any specific mitzvah, but mitzvah Drabanan in that case, but this is about the totality of obeying Chazal and not rebelling against Chazal. So too, this is about recognizing the Torah's binding authority in a general sense and not rebelling. So Rabbeinu Yonah writes in Shari Tshuva that if you have a mummer is a person who just not only sins, but basically denies the relevance of a specific mitzvah and says it just doesn't apply to him. So then Rabbeinu Yonah suggests that he's in violation of this specific pasuk, Asher Leyakim, that he doesn't accept the binding authority of the Torah in its totality. In the Sefer Avir Yaakov, quotes from somebody, Yisrael David Schlesinger, that basically suggests that this is reflection of the mitzvah of Malchus Hashem, that we have to not only do the mitzvahs, but see God as ruler, and therefore recognize the binding nature of His word in its totality. And so here's again some synergy, some perfectly timed thoughts, that he thought that that could also address the question B'Shal Salanter asks. B'Shal Salanter asks, so why is it that we have Yom Kippur only after Rosh Hashanah? Why do we have Rosh Hashanah placed before Yom Kippur? You would have thought it should be the other way around. And he suggests that this is also a part of Yom Kippur, that we have to have the Kabbalas Malchus in its totality, and since that's what Rosh Hashanah is about, so therefore it's appropriate that that comes before Yom Kippur. So those are some broad ideas that you find in that pasuk, but there's actually a lot more that's alluded to, which we'll just talk about very briefly. So the Ramban quotes two other more practical interpretations of this pasuk, or more specific, I should say, applications of this pasuk in a very different sense. Both of them suggest, both of these ideas that you can find in the Ramban, suggest that we're talking about not just the content of the Torah, which is how it's been interpreted in what we've said till now, but it's referring to the Torah itself. Asher lo yakim is divrei ha-Torah hazos. So what does it mean about a Sefer Torah? So the Ramban quotes one view, that it's a reference to a chazan beis haknesses, a chazan here, I don't think we mean specifically a cantor, but anybody, a functionary of the shul, who is not careful to make sure that the Sefer Torah is upheld, but rather lets it fall. So this is invoked in a fascinating discussion about a minig Yisrael that we have, that there is a minig that if chas v'shalom, a Sefer Torah should fall to the ground, so there is a well-known minig to fast. Fasting 40 days is a very famous aspect of it. Most of the literature about fasting for Sefer Torah, you don't find reference to 40 days. And a little bit of it you do. There is some references to 40 days. But the much greater percent of the literature just talks about fasting, not necessarily for 40 days. But that if a Sefer Torah falls, so there is this minig to fast. So the question is, where does that come from? So it's not in the Gemara at all. It's not from the Gemara, and it's not in the Shulchan Aruch either. It's really found post-Shulchan Aruch, the first codified place to find it really is the Magen Avraham. The Magen Avraham in Hilchas Tefillin talks about this idea that if one drops his tefillin, so maybe he should fast, and then he adds there, v'hu adin b'sefer Torah, and that's also the practice for a Sefer Torah. And then he says the Sefer Torah is more chumer than tefillin, because tefillin, we wouldn't say this if the tefillin were wrapped up in something, but a Sefer Torah, even if it's wrapped up in its covering, we would still say such a thing that there's a practice to fast. So if it doesn't come from the Gemara, so where does it come from? So I think if you look at all the various tshuvas and all the various discussions, so you can find basically two tracks, two schools of thought as to how to understand this minig. And I think that itself is a fascinating thing, because the way poskim address minhagim and this minig and really every minig is, you could say, all right, so it's a minig, so fine, we're obligated to keep minhagim, but in whatever the rules are, we just have to look to whatever was done is done, and whatever wasn't done, we don't know about. So there's no point in having halachic analysis of minhagim, because it's just whatever people do. So you don't find that to be the case. You find, for example, in terms of this idea of fasting for a Sefer Torah, so there are dozens and dozens of tshuvas that have been written about the subject, and they, as a whole, pretty much try to analyze it as if it's a Gemara, as if it's a din of the Gemara that you have to do this, and to try to figure out what's the lumdus. So the lumdus of this idea of fasting for a Sefer Torah, I think you could trace basically two streams. Then on the one hand, there are those who believe that it's like a siman mishamayim, that you have a message being sent to you, just like with the Egel Azav, that Moshe saw that the Jews were sinning and they need to repent, so he took the luchos and he threw them down. So too, if the Jews nowadays are sinning, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu will make the message be clear by taking the Sefer Torah, like the luchos, and letting it get thrown down to the floor. So therefore, there should be a reaction of tshuva in a general sense, that there's a message that something's wrong, and therefore there should be a response. while others understand it a little bit more narrowly, and they say it's not some generalized tshuva because there's a message coming from heaven, but rather it's a specific tshuva, that you should do tshuva for the avera of letting the Sefer Torah fall. Because, look at this Ramban, that the Ramban quotes this idea that there is aror, that there is a curse, if somebody lets a Sefer Torah fall, or a Sher Lo Yakim, who's not careful to uphold the covet of the Torah. So if you're Bechlal Arur, if you find yourself now in a cursed state, so you have to try to reverse the curse, so presumably you fast and do tshuva to escape the state of Arur, which led to a discussion. The Sefer Tzon Yosef, for example, has a whole discussion, so then maybe let's look back at the whole Parsha. Maybe everything that we just said, that's the rule, that if you're a Bechlal Arur for any of these Averis we just spoke about, so maybe you should fast in order to undo it. Which could have other Halachal Mais implications, because there is a Maharit. The Maharit in a Tshuva writes that if you're in violation of any of these Arurs, so you're Pasul Eidus. That's the implication of being cursed. So that's very, very important if that's true. Many argue on that. It's hard to believe, because like we just discussed a minute ago, it means anyone who speaks Lashon Hara is possible Eidus, in which case nobody's married because nobody has Kasher Eidim. Halavai, any of us are not possible Eidus after just reading these Pesukim. So to say that any of these automatically put you in a status of possible Eidus is hard. But in any event, it's relevant. If that's the case, all the more so, then you got to figure out, so how do I escape being Arur? How do I leave that status? So then, based on this, some discuss, maybe fasting then is the mahalach to get out of it. But in any event, they quote this Ramban, that a person who allows a Sefer Torah to fall is included in the status of Arur, and has to fast, has to do some active tshuva in order to undo it. So this stream of thought is basically saying that the fast is tshuva for this specific avera, and as the Sfarim point out, as you see from the Rambam, that kavod Sefer Torah is a unique type of halacha, that not only is one in trouble if you do something b'mezid, but even b'shogeg, if one is careless and allows this to happen, so then there's also a tshuva to be done, which we could correlate to what we said before about kibud av eim. And a kibud av eim, kibud in general, is about showing extra effort to make sure something is honored. So here, we're not claiming that anyone's trying intentionally to be mevaz the Sefer Torah, but the halachas of kavod svarim require that you go above and beyond, and that you make really sure that the Torah is protected, and that you're not going to allow it to fall. So there's many, many nafkaminas of this. I don't know if we'll have time to really go through them all, but many, many nafkaminas of this question about what is the fast based on. Is the fast a general tshuva because you have the sign from Shamayim that something's wrong? Or is it based on this Ramban, that this Avera specifically of letting the Sefer Torah fall, that's something that needs to have repentance, and that's what's being suggested by the usage of Arur. So just to very quickly touch upon some of them. So for example, there was an exchange of letters between the Tshuvas Divrei Chaim, the Sanzer Rebbe, and the Tshuvas Shem Olam, about a situation where the Gabbai of the Shul opened up the Shul in the morning, and he found that the Shul was vandalized in the middle of the night, that Ganavim broke into the Shul, and they took the Sefer Torah, and they threw them on the floor. So there you have the question. So is there an obligation to fast? So on the one hand, nobody was irresponsible. This is an act of violence done by others when the shul was properly locked up. So then you can't really blame them for it. But as far as it being a simon, so then maybe that's a simon that there is a need for repentance. Or for example, there was a machlokus between the shuvas Beis HaYotzer and the shuvas Riva. Now let's say you open up the Aron, and the Sefer Torah right away falls out because the person who put it in last time put it in a careless way. So if you want to say that it's about not being careful enough, it's really the guy who did it the day before who should be fasting, even though he wasn't there now, but it's his carelessness that made this happen. But if the issue is that it's some kind of simmon, so you could argue the person who was on the receiving end of this event, even though it wasn't his fault, then they should be the one to fast. So there's like extensive literature that one could track where really these two strands, these two ways of understanding it, are perhaps reflected in the different psakim. To make it a relevant to Yom Kippur, for example, one could also ask, let's say if the Sefer Torah Chalila should fall on Yom Kippur, so then what's the story? So one could say that if it's about a bad sign, so you could say that's as bad a sign as you can get, that here you're davening for forgiveness, and the Sefer Torah gets thrown to the floor, you could say that that's a sign of chalila rejection of the tshuva. That's a really bad sign. But if it's an Aveira, so the truth is, technically speaking, Yom Kippur is Mechaper, even for Aveiras that happen on Yom Kippur. So then one could argue that the fast that's already happening in Yom Kippur will continue and will be a Kapara for this. So that's another example of where you could have two different tracks to understand. So there's a lot of discussion to be had about this, including the question of whether the fast has to be that day, like a Tainus Chalom, which the Gemara says if you have a bad dream, you're supposed to fast that day, even on Shabbos. The assumption being that this would be comparable, a bad sign from Shemayim that you respond to automatically. Or is the idea that you could fast on a later date because it's an act of tshuva for an aveira you did that day. So some wanted to suggest a kula, which I don't think is sustainable, but if a Sefer Torah falls on Shabbos, so then you're off the hook because you have to fast on that day and you can't fast on Shabbos, so there's no point in fasting at all. But I think those are two contradictory positions, because if the idea is you have to fast on that day, it's because you're comparing it to a Tainus Chalom, and the Gemara says Tainus Chalom, you do fast on Shabbos. So it's hard to take half of it and mix it with the other half. It seems like if you want to use that comparison, then you fast on that day. And if you want to say that it's about tshuva for this, then you could fast on a different day. So got a lot more to say about this, but we're going to run out of time in a second. So just to mention, the Ramban has a whole other strand over there, where the Ramban says that maybe it's not about dropping the Sefer Torah, but it's about Hagbah, that the Torah is saying, Arur Asher Lo Yakim, that one should be making, one should hold up the Sefer Torah. He quotes the Masechta Sofrim, that you should show the Sefer Torah around in all the different directions, and everyone should be Koreya, everyone should bow down to the Sefer Torah, and that's brought in the Shulchan Aruch, and Aruch Chaim, and Kuf Lamed Daled, Sif Beis. That's what Shulchan Aruch brings, that the Sefer Torah should be held up and everyone should be Koreya. So in the Sefer Som Derech of Reb Simcha Zissel Broi, of Hebron, so he asks that L'maisa today we don't really see people being Koreya, we don't really see people bowing down. And he's not 100% sure why. I remember once many years ago I asked one of the Rashi Yeshiva here, why is it that people have a practice when Hagbah is going on to hold their finger out, to hold their pinky out? So his response to me was, because they want to test out their fingers. He doesn't know exactly what the source was. Finger exercise. Doesn't know what the motivation is. So now, this week, I happen to see in the Sam Derech, he says exactly that. He says he doesn't know why in the world people stick their fingers out. He says that doesn't seem to have any mucker. And he says it's weirder because here you do have a mucker that people should be bowing down and nobody's doing that. And instead, they're sticking their fingers out, which doesn't have any source. So it could be that he explains the idea of being Korea, that you're showing kavod to the Sefer Torah because you're trying to see what's in it, that they're holding up the ksav, and you want to see the ksav, so you're trying to get closer, so to speak. You're going to bow down a little bit, bring your head closer to it so you can see. That's an act of kavod. So maybe the pointing to it also is a way of calling attention to the text. I don't know why the pinky instead of the front finger. That part's harder to explain. But maybe that's the idea a little bit. They're of the same kind of thing. He also notes over there that the Berkei Yosef quotes from the Shiari Knesset HaGadolah, who quotes from the Shilte Giborim to Kiddushin, Yudalad and the Beis Bedape Harif, that he quotes there that you should stand up during Hagbah but not bow down, because we don't find anywhere bowing down to objects in the Torah. We don't bow down to the Aron, and so too we shouldn't bow down to the Torah during Hagbah. So one could say, again, that the same Mahalach could explain as well why he would bow down here and not to an Aron, because maybe the idea is not bowing down to the Torah, you're just trying to bring your head closer so that you can show that it's something you're interested in, and maybe therefore that could explain why you find that in the sources, that that's something to do, although again, it's not the minig nowadays to do it. So just to combine these two ideas in the Ramban, so what if during Hagbah one drops a Sefer Torah? So there are some poskim who discuss that, and they say that maybe there's a tzad to say that you should not be liable for dropping the Sefer Torah if you're in the middle of a mitzvah. Because this is based on the Gemara in Bava Kama. The Gemara says that if somebody is running to do a mitzvah and he is mazik something along the way, so it sounds like he's pater. There's a lot more to say about that. It's probably not the whole story, but for now we'll say it like that. That there's a patur of ratz berushos. You're involved in a mitzvah, so you're somewhat apparently absolved of your liability. Again, don't take that as full value, because a lot more to say about that. But if there is such a principle that you're absolved of some liability because you're in a mitzvah, so if the idea of fasting is because you were negligent in dropping the Sefer Torah, so then maybe we should say, okay, you were doing a mitzvah, you weren't negligent, so then we should take the opposite approach. So there are some shuvas that say like that. The Karlina Rav, Shelos David has a shuva along those lines. There is perhaps some position like that, but again, you have to figure out if there is such a yisod, and it would seem to depend again on how you understand the whole idea of what the fast is about. Is it because there's an avera, so we'll say, okay, your liability is reduced, or is it because of simon mishamayim, in which case you won't necessarily go that far. So just to finish the Quran, maybe we'll ask questions privately, but you could also say that this question would depend on how much of a mitzvah it is. You find this discussion by Hakafas also. Hakafas, one could argue, is not really an actual mitzvah. But if we're saying that Hag was a bigger deal, that it's part of the intent of this pasuk, so then that perhaps gives a greater defense to the one who's involved in Hagba. And that's also perhaps a part of the story. Maybe we could also bring that into the picture. If one does take such a heter that Hagba or Hakafas or anything like that, you don't have to fast, so then that's a pretty big heter because you wipe out most of the cases. That's most of the time where this question will come up, similar to the approach that we didn't like a few minutes ago of saying Shabbos Yontif, if you don't have to fast. That's also when most of these things will happen. If you put those two together, you're going to wipe out most of the applicability of this minig, and that's probably not the path to take. But in any event, I always tell people in my shul to keep Hagba at a minimum, though, because you have to be careful and you shouldn't take this as an opportunity to show off and show how strong you are, because Chalila, things could happen. So three columns, like the Magen Avraham writes, open it up three columns exactly, and display it, stick back down, no theatrics. That's what I prefer, because I think there is a big risk here. So we're just about out of time. We'll just make a quick reference, very appropriately, to the last pasuk in the Aliyah, the pasuk of Baruch Atah B'Vo'echa, Baruch Atah B'Tzeisecha. So the Targum Yonason says that those two phrases, Baruch Atah B'Me'ach B'Beis HaMedrash, so you should be blessed as you go into the Beis HaMedrash. And here's a very Torah Madar, or at least Torah Parnasa perspective, Baruch Atah B'Tzeisecha, or Baruch At V'Mifkan L'Mas L'Matan. When you go out to business, you should be blessed then as well. So it seems like there is at least a Torah Parnas, if not a Torah Mata kind of perspective there. Shmerel Shulman, Shlita and Hasef from Meirish Babira, notes that the Targum Yerushalmi has a different Targum on this, that the second part seems to not be goreis, the idea of going to work, so he has the different interpretation, b'mifkach and b'mej rasha, that as you're going out of the b'mej medrash, baruch when you go in, baruch when you go out of the b'mej medrash. So it's no work, you're going b'mej medrash both times. So Shmuel Shulman suggests that that's the machlokis, Reish Lakish, Mibishmal, that we find the Gemara and Brachas, about whether we say you should be going out and making a living or not. Could be. But we could also say differently, that maybe they're not really arguing, they're saying the same thing, that you're blessed when you go into the base medrash and blessed when you go out to work. But when you go out to work, it also should be with the bracha of leaving the base of medrash, that you should take the base of medrash with you as you go out to work, that you should continue to have that influence as part of you. And that requires a bracha. So that seems to be an appropriate note to end shir on. So baruch atah b'vo'echa, baruch atah b'tzeisecha, baruch as you came into shir, baruch as you go out to shir. Should have a wonderful Shabbos. God willing, I'll see everybody here on Sunday, bright and early. And we'll talk about some of the Yontif. Run for the Minchanabashim.